I'm John Batchelor. The President of the United States dubs it Bidenomics. Here we are, anticipating the re-election campaign of Joe Biden. What is Bidenomics? I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow of the Hoover Institution, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, who, for Defining Ideas, has laid out the Bidenomics high points of these last years, looking to the campaign of 2024. Richard, a very good evening to you. I learned from your presentation that the public is not convinced that Bidenomics is successful. The president is, and the president's critics and supporters are. So I go through some of the high points of Bidenomics and ask, is this the best we can do? We begin with energy. As we know, the growth during the Obama years, relevant here because Mr. Biden was the vice president and took credit or blame for the Obama years. The growth during the Obama years was energy, was Texas. The hiring that was done, the growth that was done across the country had to do with the oil business and especially the natural gas business. And here we are today. The Biden administration certainly enjoys the bounty of our energy fields. We're an energy superpower, maybe the energy superpower, given that Europe depends upon our liquefied natural gas and will again this winter. However, you report that Bidenomics has a different view of how to deal with energy. How so, Richard? Good evening to you.
Yeah. Well, essentially what happens is the energy question in the eyes of the Biden administration is closely tied to the climate change question. And if fossil fuels are the most efficient way in order to supply energy, fossil fuels are, in their mind, the cause of all the massive dislocation and destruction that takes place around the planet, the most recent instance being the fires that took place in Maui. If this account is right, then you can understand why it is that he's going to tamp down on this. But by the same token, if it turns out that he's wrong, then he's making the single most catastrophic mistake on the face of the globe. And my view about it is that the second view is correct with respect to this, not the first. First thing I think that one ought to do is to note that when you're talking about traditional fossil fuels, this is a very mature technology. And it turns out that virtually every stage of it is subject to the fact that you could be guaranteed to make systematic improvements from everything from drilling to final distribution in an orderly fashion. And so that if you hear a horror story about how bad energy was in 2009 when somebody fracked, what you should now understand is that if you're looking at fracking as a process, the amount of water you need is measurably smaller than it used to be. The amount of waste that's going to be thrown off is measurably less than it used to be. The yield and the accuracy of the mining and the removal is going to be far greater than it was. And so that what you have to do is not think about this as Christmas past. You have to think about it as Christmas future. And to the extent that you have these guaranteed, virtually guaranteed, technological improvements, what you should do when you start thinking about energy coming from traditional source is to assume that in 10 years, they're going to be better than they're going to be now. On the other hand, you have all the stuff with respect to the wind and the solar energy. And the constant refrain is one that's always worth repeating. The wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine. So that these are not storable sources of energy. They're going to be highly intermittent. And so the correct way to treat them is when conditions are propitious, you turn them on. But when they're not, you just leave them on. I actually, when I owned a home in Michigan, had solar panels on the roof. It's not because I'm a great devotee of solar panels, but none of the problems really existed. They were on the roof so that when things got hot, they'd send the system down 20, a signal down 20 feet, so they'd turn on the air conditioning and therefore allow you to keep the house in much greater equilibrium. So that's a use for solar panels. If you're asking me whether you should put something, you know, out in the middle of a desert somewhere, cover up the landscape and make everything very, very uncertain, have these long transmission wires, have these great periods of idleness when the sun doesn't shine, have constant degradation, the need for very intensive stuff to create these panels and then their removal, it's a completely different story. And so the way in which it works today is the subsidy that is given to solar energy is not just in the form of cash bonuses of one kind or another. It's also in the exemption from all the environmental protection laws that we want, all which are provided to fossil fuels in a way in which they had not deserved. So what's happened is you just have the complete distortion of the way in which these systems start to work. And then what happens is you say, well, this is because we have all this global warming that we have to control. And the first point to make is if you're trying to figure out where global warming is going to live or die as a disease, you have to look to China first and everything else is secondary. They already produce far more greenhouse gases than the United States. India is growing and will start to get closer to us. Already, the American system is quite conscious about how you try to bleed carbon dioxide out of the supply chain and so forth. So we've been doing a fine job without it. If you care about this, and I care less about it than most people do, and everything else that we do is a footnote. So what we're doing is we're strangling our energy type of situation. We're going to create genuine hardships. They're going to be blackouts and they're going to be brownouts about the country, because one of the things that Biden is doing is he's basically eating our seed corn and killing our future. And the key thing to understand, and this is what David Brooks in that column where he talks about the sort of optimism of the misery index, it's very low, we're doing great, is the long-term consequences of what we're doing is our capital stock in doing to deal with energy is going to be diminished substantially, so that in 5 years, everything has got to be far worse than it's going to be today. And what's the telltale sign about all this? You get Gavin Newsom, rather uncritical gent when it comes to this stuff, saying, you know, if it turns out we have an energy source, you better not charge your electronic vehicle, because the charging station you're going to do has to run on fossil fuel anyhow. It's just moving it back one particular stage. So I think you can say almost without doubt that Biden has put his energy, his money on the wrong horse. And the central point to make about this is most of the American people do not know in a great sophisticated way what's going on, but everybody seems to sense that the future is going to be worse than the past, because the gimmicks that give us jobs today and may help to lower inflation by high interest rates and so forth are not going to generate the capital stock that will allow us to keep the same level of standard of living tomorrow that we have.
Inflation Reduction Act. We come to that not on the basis of inflation only, but also the pro-union rhetoric from the Biden administration running up against what you'd have to say is the electric vehicle lobby that is seeking to profit from, and as yet, you'd have to say, unproven technology for the future. What does the unionism mean for American prosperity?
Well, unions are a very complicated phenomenon in this case, I should tell you. I have one person who consistently opposed union power since the passage of the Wagner Act in 1935. And in 1983, when I first wrote about this in the Yale Law Journal, I was denounced because I believed that the entire union movement was, in fact, incorrect. But if you're living in a world where unions are a given, the question you have to ask on any particular issues, are they right or are they wrong? And when it comes to energy, the unions are a little bit of both. They understand that what Biden is going to do is going to decimate huge numbers of jobs in the energy industry, which are unionized, and huge number of jobs in the automotive industry. And they are very resentful about a fact that says, I'm the most pro-union president in the world, is going to help them on some local election to get union representation and then decimate the industry on which they depend. The unions are well aware of the fact that the number of people in the automobile industry has shrunk vastly from what it was 50 years ago. And they realize to some extent it's their own policies that had led to this particular kind of decline with the rise in non-union plans in places like Tennessee and Mississippi. All right, so they know all that stuff. And now they see him pushing very hard for this other kind of energy source. And they know that they're going to be out of business in some way. And so what they say is, look, this is what we want. We want you either to keep this business safe, or if you want to put another business in place, what you have to do is to make sure we get the same number of union jobs out of that one. It's not at all clear when you move to technologies from one thing to another that you're going to employ the same mix of workers with the same kinds of situation. So even if Biden promised to unionize the solar and wind energy business, it's doubtful that it would be able to create the same number of jobs that these guys have in conventional work. So the UAW is now withholding its endorsement of Biden. It's not that they're going to vote Republican. But remember, if you take a very large chip off of one side of a balance beam, you're making a change in the balance, even if you don't put that chip on the other side of the balance beam. It lightens up what's on your side. So he has a very serious problem. And what happens is he's trying to spend a lot of money on technology, which will do what? Well, you start asking yourself the following simple question. What are the numbers of degrees or fractions of degrees that you are going to be able to reduce in global temperature if you put this program in place? And my friend Ben Zeica constantly says, if you look at all the government studies, if you're going to get a tenth of a degree out of this in the next 50 years, you're lucky. And so we are spending trillions in order to achieve nothing. And that's why it is that this thing is so crazy. If you're trying to figure out what's going on, it's important to understand the situation. There is a common methodology today. You see, any adverse event is always due to the change in the levels of carbon monoxide, or rather carbon dioxide. One of the things that you start to know is that the increase in carbon dioxide is generally very slow. It's inexorable. It's probably around 415 parts per million today, up from maybe 385 or 390 10 years ago. Up it goes a little bit. But then you get these huge events. And if you actually track the number of major incidents, it's just a complete random event. One year, you'll have very low payments from the insurance industry because there are very few catastrophes. The next year, it will quadruple, and then it will go down again. None of this huge change can be attributable to the changes in carbon dioxide levels. It's always going to be something that's local that's going to drive this. So take Maui. This is a case in which it's a green state, i.e., a democratic state. And what they did is they basically decided they wanted to improve the world by investing more in renewable energies. And so the public utility company, they did not keep its lines free of vegetation, didn't maintain their service levels and so forth, didn't do adequate inspection. The whole thing blows up. You read the New Yorker, reliable Elizabeth Colbert. She's saying, well, this is a temperature change of 2 degrees, which managed to change it. And then the next day you see the state is suing the electric company for a breach of its various duties. And the defense is going to be, we did exactly what you told us. Don't take it out on our shareholders. Take it out on our citizens. And one of the things to understand about litigation like this is the losses have already happened. And you're going to have to figure out who's going to bear the cost. But if every actor in the system is completely irresponsible, as they've been in the state of Hawaii, nothing is going to change in the future unless they change their future practices. And that they seem to be unwilling to do. So what the game is always attributes something to global warming, at which point you could then point to nature and say, what we're doing is minimizing this particular loss. When in fact, what they're doing is they're compounding the loss and they're wasting huge amounts of money spending it on technologies that won't produce any benefits.
I want to go to Wall Street, Richard, because you're introducing a publicly traded company that's being punished right now for its poor regulations or too acute regulations these last years. But there's a larger story here. I can guess that the Hawaii Electric Company was part of the ESG portfolios of BlackRock. So when we come back, Richard Epstein looking at Bidenomics and why it is that the polling tells us in all the major newspapers that the American public is unhappy. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Time for a sofa upgrade? Visit washablesofas.com and discover Anabay, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices, with sofas starting at $699. Anabay brings you the ultimate in furniture innovation with a modular design that allows you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabay is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquid simply slides right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink-in feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get up to 60% off plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.